I was watching a video of Swami Kriyananda, the founder of Ananda, most of you know. He left this planet in 2013, in April. And this was a film that had been taken when he was living for about a year in Los Angeles. That would have been 2010 and 2011. And he would give Sunday morning satsangs there. During that period of time, he would start his satsangs at 11. We changed our schedule a little bit so that at 11 o'clock we could watch him live in Los Angeles. And it was a very nice time for all of us. And in one of those Sunday satsangs, he was answering questions. By that time in his life, Swamiji was quite frail. And especially right at that time, 2010, the last few years of his life, his consciousness shifted in a very dramatic way, and his relationship to ordinary reality became quite different. For all the decades that I'd watched him before and known him before, since 1969 and through the 70s, 80s, 90s, I was always, I saw him often and spoke to him often and spent years listening to his talks. And whatever little bit I know about the spiritual path, I learned from him. And he was, as a young man, quite different than all of us are. And Helen was reading today, and I was touched by that. Your body ages, but you remain the same. These are such simple things to say, but they're very subtle things for the mind to grasp. I've crossed over 70 at this point, and it's a big difference. Being 70 is a big difference than being 50. Even though my body still works really well, I'm just aware of the fact that it can't do what it used to do. It just doesn't have. I remember talking to Chidambar at one point when I had to climb up onto a piece of furniture, and I just found that I couldn't do it. I said, is it lack of courage? Is it lack of balance? Is it lack of strength? It wasn't obvious to me which one of those factors was at play, but something that I could have just done easily suddenly became quite problematic. Listening to Helen talk, I was thinking how consistently we are ourselves, but that the vehicle that we move through keeps going through all these changes, and how extremely difficult it is to keep those two realities separate. We can talk about it and philosophize about it, but the instinctive response that I am my body, I am a child, I am an adult, I am an older person, whatever it might be, these are inner battles we have to fight all the time. Swami Kriyananda remarked about himself as a child. He said he always got along well with adults because he never saw them as essentially different than himself. And it wasn't mean that he saw them as children. He just saw them all as souls relating. So he had a very direct way. In his autobiography, he describes how his nanny, his nurse, they called them then, but the one who took care of the children, governess, he said that she remarked about how he had a very disconcerting way of just looking right at grown-ups, you know, as if he had a right to treat them as if they were peers. Because in his own inherent, without having any philosophy as a child, he just knew who he was. He put it, I was born fully myself, is how he put it. Just amusingly, he was also talking about the fact, Swami, of course, was a great writer, and he was talking about reincarnation and the obvious fact that he came in knowing. And he says when he was about five or something, he wrote a little story. And in the story, as children do, he connected every sentence with the word and. So it was just like one big, long story. And his mother read it and said that it was very good, but perhaps there were a few too many ands in it. And Swami said at the age of five, he looked at her and he said, how do you know? You're not a teacher, you're just a mother. But he says what it was who is anyone to tell me how to write? Of course, he was only five. I remember taking ballet lessons at the age of six, And I had a karmic memory of being a lot better than I was at six. And my whole recollection of it, for decades, was especially one particular recital with the pink tutu and the silver ribbon and the silver ribbon in my long curly hair, the whole thing. And then I saw a photograph, you know, and even in the photograph, there was a big disconnect between my inner experience and what my little body knew how to do at that particular point. You know, we're all running through these realities of great separation and deeper, what do I want to say, deeper realization than we ourselves realize, which is actually the only way to put it. So as Swami's body aged, it was just fascinating to watch. Because I recently published a big biography of Swami's life, and in the course of that had to think about everything, and also looked at many photographs. It was so impressive how if you looked at a picture of him when he was a child and just took the face, and then you looked at him when he was, as you know, the last years of his life and just took the face, his face had the same expression on it. Swami himself said when he looked at pictures of himself, like, you know, baby in the bathtub kind of pictures, he said he would just look in the eyes and he said it was the same old fellow, is how he put it. Just the same spirit, just living through. Now think about the extraordinary freedom that would give us. I mean, not only in childhood, but in all these stages of life, if we could be the observer of the play, and always keeping that single thought that we're only here for this one purpose. And yes, we have to do all these things because it's through all of those activities, this compelling need for companionship, this desire to raise children, this compulsion to use our talents, to serve other people. All of these forces are not contrary. And this is one of the subtleties of the spiritual path. They're not contrary to that unchanging eternal consciousness. They're the means by which that consciousness over many incarnations refines itself. Because we're a maelstrom of conflicting understandings. And unless those conflicting understandings are brought out into the light of day, enlightenment never comes to us. The Gita, there's long verses in the Gita about action versus inaction, because there's this confusing idea that, well, if the goal of life is God realization, why do we participate at all? But resistance is also an action. And that resistance is always born of fear, the fear to engage. It's not born of the lack of necessity to engage. It's born of the memory of the broken heart and the desire not to have it happen again. And the challenge of the spiritual life is to be able to recognize the nature of this world and still not be afraid to engage in it. The phrase broken heart is a phrase that has been in my mind lately, and I was thinking about the song that we do at the end of, toward the end of the festival. And the song is Long We Feared to Face Your Love. This is a song actually that Swamiji wrote inspired by the crucifixion of Jesus, by the extraordinary selfless sacrifice that the masters bring to the world, where they are willing, even though there is no compelling need within them, that all karma has been resolved, but they take on the realities of human life to show us what the potential is. And the extraordinary life of Christ, which is the season that we're in right now, you know, begins with this joyous celebration of his birth, but it ends with the extraordinary sacrifice of the crucifixion, which is not about Jesus' suffering. It's about Jesus' courage to participate in whatever was needed in order to set the example and to give the power to others to be able to do the same. And so Swami wrote this song, You Remain Our Friend, and it says, long we feared to face your love, lest our emptiness it prove. Now at last our hearts we give you, who remain our friend. Other part of that verse is, that song is, that God is always there, waiting to uplift us, and we are always afraid to open up to that potential. When I was in India in July and August and September, I just put myself into the hands of my hosts in the various cities and allowed them to choose whatever topics they wanted because they knew what their audiences needed. I couldn't really make it up from here. And I also have to say, quite frankly, after decades and decades of having to make up my own class titles, I'm finished. It's a privilege of age. I'm done. You can do it. So the concept of Jivan Mukta means freed while living. And it's an aspiration that is put in front of us, that Master put in front of us and Swami put in front of us sometimes. You know, finish your karma in this incarnation. So even while you're inhabiting a human body, you'll still be freed. The Jivan Mukta. And then oftentimes, a soul who really has nothing more to learn for himself still keeps reincarnating, is how Master put it, with whatever little bit of unfinished business there is that allows him to come back over and over again. I believe Swami Kriyananda was a Jivan Mukta, where the way it's put is the ego is dissolved, but there's a little bit of karma that still is running, but it's not personal anymore. That's the best I can describe it because I don't know anything about it, which is the whole point of this story. So because the great ones suggest to us that we can, in fact, become freed in this lifetime and become Jivan Muktas, it's always been an issue within the context of Ananda, those who are determined to become Jivan Muktas and those like me who figure, well, whatever it is, I'm doing my best. But I get to Mumbai, and one of my topics is how to become a Jivan Mukta in this lifetime. And the first thing I did was, I was sick for one day in India, so I managed to get sick on that one day, and I got to cancel it. It was a private satsang, so it was easy to do, but unfortunately, or fortunately, I got better, and so I had to do it after all. So I arrive at this lovely apartment with dear friends, Ayush and a few others there. And I just had to say, it's like, you know, I surrendered to this and this is what happened to me. But I said, I never talk about this topic. Because first of all, I think Swami was a Jivan Mukta and the difference between him and me is just too great. That's what it looks like and it doesn't look like me. And also I said, I don't need the pressure. It's just real simple, you know. I'm already a little bit high-strung. There was an article decades ago in Psychology Today. This is in the 70s. You know, I've lived through this now a long time. In the 70s when all this Eastern religion and meditation was coming in and so on. And in the American way where we always have to be so shrewd and be so careful never to be taken advantage of, Psychology Today puts out the magazine probably doesn't even exist anymore. I mean, magazines don't exist anymore. Does it still exist? It said, the dark side of meditation. You know, and this was our world, so we were really interested in it. The dark side of meditation was actually turned out to be a better article than I thought. The dark side of meditation is incredibly overachieving type A personalities that are always wound up are going to learn to meditate to do something about the stress. But all of a sudden, not only do you have to be good, you have to be therefore perfect as our Father in heaven is perfect. And so the stress, you know, multiplies because now I have to be absolutely perfect, right? And this is the dark side of meditation. But in fact, it's true. I had that, you know, in my paper files, I had that article for decades and I would pull it out and share it with people regularly because it's true. We enter onto the spiritual path because of this promise of bliss, this promise of freedom, this sense of the comforter, this belief, if we become disciples, that there is a true friend in this world. That's Swami's beautiful song, "You remain our friend, even though," and the verse says, "eternally rejected," meaning that just the dark side is always there. And Jesus himself, the tragedy for him of the crucifixion was not the loss of his body. You know, he just put it back together again, and he just walked around in it. Birth and death were absolutely nothing to him. The tragedy of it was that he offered this freedom, and instead people rejected him. Not only did they reject the freedom, they just absolutely rejected him. They crucified him. What a story. You know, and they, before he was crucified, there's a place you can go in Jerusalem, which is the place where Jesus wept, because he knew that he had brought to these people this freedom and that they were not going to accept it. That broke his heart. The nature of this world, where fulfillment is offered beyond this world, but people cling to this world instead. Long we feared to face your love. Long we feared to really understand that what we seek is possible, but not by the means that we're trying to achieve it. You know? And that is, I was writing to a friend, and I was saying, it took me a long time to understand that Swamiji experienced a life, that Swami suffered. That's the only way I can think of it. That Swami felt pain, but he didn't resist it. It was the nature of this world. You know, when you go to the dentist, you understand that the dentist is going to have to, you know, put a needle in your mouth, which might make you very uncomfortable, but you recognize that this is the way the process happens. If you go to have blood taken, they're going to put the needle in your arm. If you are going to try to be a powerful athlete, there's times when it's just not pleasant to do it. You have to make yourself different. I'm going to just go in here for a moment. For a long time, we had this wonderful man, Matthew Sloan, who was part of our school here, was a trained actor, wonderful actor, and really a big man. He could stand and fill this room with his voice without a microphone. And when he would work with the children in our school, on our school play, he was very dramatic with them. And when he was exhorting them to do better, they were not putting out enough energy one day. And he had them running from one end of the room to the other like this. They would all run to the end, and when they would get there, he would make them shout, "I will suffer for my art." And then he would have them run back and then affirm it again like that. I would be working on the costumes up there. I'd just be in hysterics. But after that, they would try harder, because they had understood, if we're going to be good, we're going to have to put out energy for it, and it's not always going to be an easy and pleasant. Well, that is an absurd and utterly entertaining example, but on a much more profound level, Swami understood that you have to walk through this world. You have to experience the realities. Well, Master put it this way. He said, everything that you're no longer attracted to, it's because you've tried it and you have realized what it will and won't do for you, and then you're willing to give it up. And he included, you know, murder, thievery, everything, every possible thing that human nature imagines will give it fulfillment. The way Swami put it, which is very profound, you learn something from being disappointed. He said, but when you really learn is when your desires are fulfilled. Because when they're fulfilled, it's not that you end up thinking, oh, this world is ugly and horrible, like that. It's that you just realize, oh, It's not enough. And it's not bad. Sometimes it's really quite glorious. But it's not enough. Because anything that's related to this ever-changing universe eventually will change and go away from us. You know, a lifetime of a great love, somebody will die. And then where will it be? And it's not that it wasn't beautiful, it's just that it wasn't eternal. And what happens is that we are fulfilled, and then that fulfillment leads to heartbreak. But then something in us says, you know, this isn't the way it's meant to be. And so instead of rebelling, we begin to accept. Oh yes, this is the way life is. People do their best. But people are bound. Everybody here is bound by ego. That's what I saw in Swami's life. You know, people were bound by ego. And people get caught up in their own desires. And they get caught up in thoughts are universal, not individual. We get caught up in waves of energy. And those waves of energy just carry us. And we do things that either in that lifetime or lifetimes later, we think, what could I have been thinking? You know, isn't it stunning when we finally perceive an error that we've made, that we've been committed to perhaps for a very long time, and then it finally crosses our minds, oh my gosh, there's another way to look at this. And you think, how could I not have known it? But of course, I didn't, because if I did, I would have behaved differently, wouldn't I? Or I knew, but I just didn't have the strength within me. And we just go over this again and again, and the heart breaks again and again and again. But what it does, you see, is it breaks open. And, you know, there's lots of beautiful poetic ways of putting it. Where the cracks are is where the light can shine through. My image is always of the submarine trying to hold the ocean at bay, and where the cracks form, then the ocean can come in. And that ocean is Divine Mother's love all around us, trying to say to us, I have so much more to give you. Okay, if you want this toy, I'll give you that one. Okay, you can have this one. And then she just waits until we're done playing with it. You know, the child sometimes is more interested in the box than in the toy that's inside. But when you're finally finished playing with the box, Divine Mother will say, this is what I really wanted to give you. You know, and then I was talking, going back to the Jivan Muktas in that apartment when I was talking to those people there. I told them, you know, it's not that I wouldn't love to realize God. You know, if when I take my last breath, I'm freer than I think I am. I mean, I'm not going to resist. I'm going to say, my, that's nice, isn't it? But in the meantime, I'm doing everything I can. Now, it's not like I get up in the morning and say, oh, I think I'll just make a half effort today. I think I'll be half miserable and half happy, you know, half loving God and half just not. No, one gets up in the morning every morning, at least I do, and just think, you know, here I am, one more time. But it was interesting, it was very interesting when I was talking to those people, I said, and I had to just be honest, if God came to me right now and wanted to take me away from everything, just dissolve this world and take me away, I said, I wonder if I would be able to do it. I was talking to someone about the possibility of discontinuing medical treatment. A person who has serious health issues, not so serious, it's not hospice serious, but it's just like, this medical treatment is pretty extreme, maybe I won't do it. And we just talked about a few things that they still were interested in this world. Simple question, are you willing to give them up? And the immediate thought was, no, I'm not. You know, so it's not that we have to think less or more of ourselves. What I'm trying to say is we just have to accept who we are and then take whatever that is and with our whole hearts just open it to God. Swamiji said when he was a young monk, he was invited, he often told this story, he was invited To demonstrate the yoga postures at a bar mitzvah reception in Beverly Hills. I mean, he never really explains the whole thing, but every so often you think, what? But for one reason or another, there he was doing it, and he ends up having a conversation with a Beverly Hills psychiatrist about whether or not there are miracles. And the psychiatrist was quite a materialist, and so Swami starts telling about the miracles that he's witnessed with Master. And then later, Master, when they're just having lunch, after lunch, Swami said he used to serve for Master, serve the guests, and then they would talk afterwards. Master just says very casually, you know, when you're with atheistic, materialistic people, better not talk about miracles. You know, it's not convincing. It just makes them think that you're nuts. You know, it doesn't help the cause. But Swami's response, because Master was nowhere near, he wasn't even in the same city, and Swami hadn't told anyone. And Swami just, with astonishment, says to his guru, you knew? Like this? Very casually, Master says, I know every single thought that you think. Now, think about that for a minute. Swami said, you know, it was a little disconcerting to him for a moment to realize that. Now, of course, he had invited Master into his consciousness. Master would not invade without the invitation. But then Swamiji realized how wonderful that was. Just how absolutely wonderful. That I am who I am. And my guru is taking me completely. Divine Mother is taking me in completely. She's not weighing and measuring. There is no dark side to our relationship with God. There just isn't. We just are what we are. And if I'm holding on here with one hand to this desire, and this hand is holding on to God, but this hand is still firmly clutching whatever, you know, make your own list. You all have your own list. Mostly it's people, but it's other things. I still want to be recognized for this. I still want to accomplish that. I still want an apology from this one. I still want revenge on that one, you know. Would we really just be able to put it down? No. What Master tells us above all is just love God. That's what our whole reading is about. Don't just go through the motions. And going all the way back to where I started when Swami was in Los Angeles, you know, he was a brilliant question answerer. He could just tune into what people were asking and universalize the particular and give these fantastic answers. So he's here, and all of a sudden come to the part in the satsang where people are asking questions. And they're asking the kinds of questions people usually ask. I have a very strong-willed child. What do I do with it? One man asks, you know, why does God have gender? Why is he? Or, you know, just all the kinds of questions. And I was sort of anticipating Swami's answers, having heard him talk for so long. The man asks, why do we talk about God as he if God is beyond gender? Swami says, you know, I went to Carmel once and I didn't have any money. And he starts telling this whole story about how Divine Mother paid his hotel bill and Divine Mother gave him this. And then the man says, well, if you're going to talk about he, why would you talk about she, since God transcends? And so then my car broke, and I didn't have any money, and I got a check from Divine Mother. And, you know, this poor guy is, you know, like this. But he did that multiple times. Questions that were asked on this level, Swami just answered it here. And I had multiple impressions just watching that film. One was, Swami knows he's never going to see these people again. This is his one chance. And he could give them an answer that they could finish by the afternoon, or he could give them an answer that they could spend incarnations working on. In my book, Swami Kriyananda, as we have known him, there's a story about a satsang in Reno, Nevada that he gave at a church of religious science there. And it was a very unusual night. And afterwards, Swami stood, and people came to greet him. And I always would watch him, so I stood sort of over there. And he was really not in his body. He was present, but he was not where other people were. And these people, and this just because of the group, none of them were going to become disciples of Master or take Kriya in this lifetime. But all of them had the karma. And I just watched them, and they would sort of come in front of Swami, and I would just watch him give them as much of the consciousness of God as they could take, even in whatever they were talking about. And then the next one would move. It was just like this. That's what I was watching him do in Los Angeles. You've asked me a question from here, but this is what your soul wants. And you don't understand me, but you will. But you will. You know? That's what we're working with all the time. I don't know if I'll be a Jivanmukta in this lifetime. It's really up to them. It's not up to me. But I will be. And in the meantime, we just open ourselves and give of ourselves. Long I feared to face your love because of the emptiness that I would have to acknowledge. I would have to acknowledge that this world isn't working for me. But now, my whole heart I give you. Every week we sing it. Let's really mean it, okay? God bless you.